We're back on the campus of Bloomsburg University talking to Dr. Cynthia Venn. She is an oceanographer and a geologist and a professor here at Bloomsburg University, and a senior professor. Do we use that phrase around here?
Pretty senior.
Well, anybody who was already an established professor when I interviewed you 8 years ago, and now
I guess so.
You're still here. If you weren't then, you are now. So,
yeah.
Well, very, very glad to be back, and thank you for your time. I'm going to start this interview out the same way I did the first one. Why should oceans be a brought-up topic? Just how important are our oceans?
Oceans are critical to our survival, even if we don't live near the ocean, because they cover 70% of the Earth's surface. They absorb a lot of the carbon dioxide we're putting in the air. They're the reason we're not really toasty at this point. They provide a lot of the fisheries. They mediate the climate. And there are parts of it we still haven't explored, and so we don't even know what all we might be able to get out of the oceans that's useful. Interesting.
You mentioned we just discovered some new coral reefs.
Yes, after the we knew there were deep sea coral reefs had been that are very deep ocean. So most coral reefs that we think of, the ones that are beautiful colors that people dive on, have to be within maybe the top 60, 80 feet, 100 feet, usually something like that deep. But these are down maybe 10 times that deep and on the deeper continental slope, and they don't have any color to them because they don't have those photosynthesizing microbes that live in their body. And they tend to live long, long periods of time, like 1,000 years. And they grow very, very slowly. And we knew that there were some off of Norway and some other deep spots. But in the explorations that have come after the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, they've discovered many, many more of these deep sea reefs. And they're looking at trying to see the effects of the oil on them, although they didn't know they were there before, so they don't really have a baseline. And they've also discovered a large number of these reefs off of the East Coast, down at about 100 meters, 200 meters, 300 meters, going all along the, which is three football fields, basically, all along the edge of the continent, off from the edge of the continent, and basically marking the boundary between that shallower water and then the deep ocean.
And you mentioned this submersibles, manned submersibles, and remote-operated vehicles have enabled us to do more research in the bottom of the ocean.
Yes, absolutely. There are not that many manned submersibles, and they work all the time, but ROVs are these remotely-operated vehicles, these robots that you can operate from a ship. There's a number of those, and in the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration has a ship for exploration called, I think it's the Okeanos, and they are out all the time doing these, they call them voyages of discovery, and it's pretty cool because they're right on the internet, and you can kind of look at all the things that are going on, and they have done a big survey of the ones off the southeast coast, that and those reefs stretch from offshore Florida all the way up to Massachusetts.
And carbon dioxide, oxygen balance, the ocean is the decider and in control. Explain why and how critical that is.
Okay, so carbon dioxide and oxygen are linked because carbon dioxide is needed by plants to photosynthesize, and their waste product is oxygen. So anywhere you have enough light for photosynthesis, which in the ocean is in very shallow, clear water, or anywhere at the surface of the ocean, pretty much, then you're going to be taking in carbon dioxide, and that's constantly supplied from the atmosphere because the atmosphere or the water loves to absorb carbon dioxide. It's much better at absorbing carbon dioxide than any other gas. And then that produces oxygen in that water. And what supplies oxygen to the deep ocean is surface water in very cold areas sinks, and then that takes the oxygen that's in that surface water down to those deep sea fish and to the organisms that live in the deep sea. And that water basically circulates around the bottom of the oceans and then eventually gets forced up to the surface again.
What's the state of our oceans?
Oh, not as good as they used to be, I guess. You see many reports. I mean, some folks say it's dire. I know that if we talk about fisheries, for instance, about 90% of the large fish are gone because as we fish for to eat, and we deplete stocks near shore, then we've been able to go further and further offshore. And the new factory, you have essentially factory fishing. You have these very large ships that can be out for a long period of time, and they collect a lot of fish. And so they've been sort of decimating the fish populations, especially the large fish like tuna, swordfish, sharks. Sharks are in a very sad state because of between the sharks being harvested for shark fin soup and everybody being scared of sharks and just killing them for fun. Yeah, it's very sad with sharks.
Okay, so should I not eat tuna?
I don't eat tuna. I don't eat tuna for two reasons. It's the way they catch them. Dolphins also can often get trapped with the tuna. There are so few tuna out there. And tuna and swordfish are the ones that can basically concentrate mercury. So with coal-fired power plants particularly, mercury goes into the atmosphere, and then it comes down in rain, and then it gets incorporated into the water, and then it gets picked up by fish. So I no longer eat tuna very often.
We occasionally hear about clean coal, which I personally know is a myth, but you can tell us that we don't scrub out mercury even with clean coal emissions.
That's correct, yeah. Coal has many things in it other than just carbon that we burn. It has uranium, it has mercury, it has arsenic quite often. It has all those things that get sort of sequestered or concentrated when you have a no-oxygen environment, which is how coal forms in the first place. You have organic material, mostly trees and plants. It fell down, got buried in a swamp, and didn't rot away. They simply collected there. And that's the kind of environment where these heavy metals can also be concentrated.
So as somebody concerned about our global environment, you were heartened, happier to see that coal was on its way out. Certainly not ideal for the industry itself, and we didn't wish it upon them. But to see a resurgence of coal would have to be concerning.
That concerns me a great deal, not only because of the ocean parts of it, but also because I live in Pennsylvania, and I see the effect of coal mines. Part of what I do is aqueous geochemistry, which is we look at the water quality around Pennsylvania. My students have done a lot of abandoned mine drainage analyses, and it's not pretty.
Yeah. What about the climate change? We know our planet's getting warmer. We know our oceans are getting warmer. So what's the impact of climate on the oceans?
Well, several things. So if the climate warms, all right, then warm air can hold much more moisture. So more ocean evaporates into the air, and you get stronger and much wetter storms, such as Hurricane Harvey in Houston that dropped 50-something inches and flooded many, many homes, including my sister's. And then much more and warmer air then also creates larger storms, because as that warm, moist air hits the cold air, say, in the tornado belt, we've been getting all those incredibly strong storms going through Nebraska and all the way through the Midwest. And that seems to be somewhat due to the fact that we've got more warm air that has a lot more moisture in it. And so you get more powerful storms. Go ahead. And then the other thing that can happen is as the atmosphere warms, then the ocean warms. And when the ocean warms, it expands. And part of sea level rise is due not just to the fact that glaciers might be melting and going into the ocean. It just takes more space to have, on average, warmer water.
If you were on my talk show right now and you said, well, the oceans are climbing and getting warmer and the air is getting warmer, somebody would call our audience and say, bah. Okay?
Yeah.
Not to be overly frank about it.
Mm-hmm.
Ah. How can you, what do you say to that?
Meaning that they don't believe
it? Well,
it's not
true. I read that one of the ice caps got bigger this year, or... in New York, they're just building a seawall so they can handle this.
Yes. So, yeah, something we can deal with. Well, if we all want to have seawalls, I guess we could keep the ocean out. But how are you going to let all that fresh water that the hurricane just dumped on you out into the ocean? And I think we can, particularly this year, and, you know, weather is weather and climate is different. Climate's the average, you know. And so this year I just got back from Southern California. Never rains in Southern California, right? Rained on me and my students for five of the first 5 days. And then it got very cold, but that was just vagaries of the storms. There have been a lot more storms, a lot more rain. When I flew back, the Midwest, you could tell from the airplane, it was just, there were no fields that were green because they were all still flooded from all those rains. Just
our planet is getting warmer as part of a natural cycle. There's nothing we can do.
Ah, well, it is a natural cycle. That doesn't, I mean, it can't, but part of it is a natural cycle. We're between ice ages, so of course we're warming up. But we're warming up, if you look at the records of actual temperature rise, we're not just kind of warming up. If you look at the we can tell from carbon dioxide that's trapped in glaciers from way back, we can go back 180,000 years looking at basically carbon dioxide values, and also oxygen isotopes can tell us what the temperature was. And you can see the variations, but then it's like you get to about 100 years ago and it's just launched to that, you know, to the stratosphere. And so essentially it is precipitous warming. So the question, and sometimes the question is not who causes it, you know, is it caused by increased CO2 because of, you know, burning fossil fuels? I believe it is. But there's also CO2 that comes out of volcanoes. There's other sources of CO2. But the question is, we shouldn't spend so much energy saying why, except to address what we can address, which is if we know of sources of CO2 we can sort of mitigate, then we should lower those sources of CO2. We're not going to be able to put a cork in a volcano, but we can certainly burn less coal. We can certainly try and generate less CO2 on our own.
What can we do? What should we do?
I think alternative fuels are a good idea. I think Gio went on this trip that I had my class in Southern California. We looked at a lot of solar farms, and solar energy does have its own impacts, though. I mean, it takes up a lot of space, a lot of ground, and the best place to do it is in the desert, right, because there's no trees and things. However, the desert tortoise is getting all impacted, so you have to balance wildlife and those things. I think the most innovative solar farm I've seen was they had a bunch of solar panels that were providing shade for the cows in the feedlot.
Okay.
So that seemed to be,
well, good.
You know, and also solar panels on top of the parking covers in places like Death Valley. So you can kind of get a double amount. There was also a lot of wind power out there, and windmills have gotten much more efficient and able to generate much more power with much less detriment to birds, so that might be also a good thing.
I would like it if you would have some solar panels in the faculty lot that I'm parked in, because there's no trees there, so that wouldn't work. So, but there's cause for hope, because we've identified some things we can do. We started to do some things that can affect the climate, and there's a lot of people who are on board this. You're cranking out some inspired students that are going to make a big difference. There is hope. This isn't a hopeless discussion that we're having.
Oh, I agree. There is much hope. I think we just need to not spend our energy arguing with each other and just try to come up with solutions.
The Marianas Trench.
Marianas Trench.
Marianas Trench now has nuclear fallout and microplastic beads in it.
Yes, in fact.
Deepest ocean known to man,
right,
is polluted.
It is, yep. And I would, if the the Marianas Trench is close to islands, so, you know, it's close to the Marianas Islands, and the worst plastic pollution in the ocean is in that zone of Indonesia, India, but particularly Indonesia, sort of in that zone. So maybe they have a larger supply. However, microplastics have been detected in oysters in every ocean in the world, including the Arctic, which has. And I go to the southern tip of South America try to go every year to go fly fishing, but that's just for fun.
Well, good for you.
So down in Tierra del Fuego, where you can go all day without seeing a person, it's very windy, and when we're driving down, there are plastic bags that are hung up on the fences that are just blowing like crazy. So and that's down at the bottom of the world. There's no one around there except the farm, you know, the ranches right there. And so I think the importance of reducing plastic, reducing packaging, reducing single-use plastics. In California, when we were just there, they want you to bring your own bags, if you get a grocery bag, you have to pay for it, and it's reusable plastic. It's some kind of reusable plastic bag if it's plastic. And they give you the option. They say, you want a bag, you're just going to carry it out.
So back to our solutions idea, this idea of rejecting anything with any kind of plastic is an ideal. If you use a plastic, make sure that you're using it as many times as you can, and then recycling it, or at least disposing of it properly.
Right.
But plastics are popping up all over. How does this happen?
Well, part of it is actually from laundry. A lot of the microplastics, you know, if you have your Patagonia, you know, synthetic jacket or whatever, you know, that I have a bunch, and you wash it, then those little fibers go out into a septic tank, so they don't make it to the river, but most places they go to the sewage treatment plant, and then it goes, you know, that they don't take the plastics out, and these little microplastics get in the river and eventually in the ocean.
And then the ocean circulates the globe.
And the ocean circulates the globe. Ocean does a complete circuit in about every 1,000 years, I think was the thing I heard.
But that's sufficient for us to get plastic up to the North Pole and pretty close to the South Pole.
The surface ocean circulates a lot faster than that. So, for instance, the debris from the earthquake, the Fukushima earthquake, you know, the earthquake in Japan in 2011, 2 years after that, they were picking up debris from that in California because it just went around the current. And so that what they call the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, there's sort of two zones that have highly concentrated plastics in the Pacific Ocean, one kind of east of Hawaii and one kind of west of Hawaii. And what happens is the things can get carried around that big circular current in the North Pacific, but the wind patterns are such that they sort of force surface water towards roughly 25 degrees north and 25 degrees south. So anything floating is going to get stuck there. The old name for the that area in the Atlantic Ocean was called the Sargasso Sea. And the Sargasso Sea was that zone that's about where the Bermuda Triangle is, if you're familiar with that, and kind of right off Florida, sort of in that western central part of the North Pacific Ocean. And there was this floating seaweed called sargassum that just gets stuck in there and never gets out. Right? I tell my students if they were going to name it now, they'd call it the Styrofoam Cup Sea, because that's what's floating in there now.
And none of the seagrass is there?
Some of the seagrass is there. I've seen some of the sargassum as well. And it only floats. It's normally stuck to rocks and things. But when you get a big storm, what those kind of algae, they want their leaf-like things, the fronds, to be up. So lots of them have little air bladders on them. Like kelp is the same way. It has air bladders to kind of hold it upright. But if the hold fast, the thing that holds it to the rock, gets ripped, then it floats.
And then it moves out.
Yeah.
Okay. We hear about nonprofit efforts to clean up the ocean. Describe these efforts.
Yeah, there's one I recently heard about that has been developed, that they want to take a thing out to this big net out to the Pacific Garbage Patch, and it's like a big boom, and they're going to gather all this plastic, and then I forget how many tons, but and then they figure in a couple of weeks they can get so many tons, and then they'll take it and repurpose it or recycle it and stuff. And that'll be interesting to follow, because one thing about anything that floats in the ocean is suddenly you've got like shade or something, and organisms will attach to it. So there might be a whole zone of critters that are associated with that plastic that have adapted or you know, just hanging out there. And so you might be wiping out a whole bunch of things in addition to taking out the plastic. I'm not sure if they've done any like feasibility studies on that or not.
So restoring the balance could be negative for something that's living there. You just never know. We met you 8 years ago. Well, we had met you probably 10 years ago with the Susquehanna River Heartland Coalition for Environmental Studies, but we interviewed you 8 years ago to talk about the Gulf oil spill 1 year in. So 9 years ago, BP lost billions of gallons of crude oil in the Gulf of Mexico. What has been the long-term impact that we know about?
Well, the BP funded a research institute, Gulf of Mexico Research Institute, after the spill. And so they have actually funded, and these are not there are scientists doing their science, but they funded a lot of science in the Gulf of Mexico. And what they found is that a lot of that oil has been incorporated down into the sediments. What happens in the oceans, there's this material they call marine snow, which are all these little particles and things that are floating in the water. If you think of a jellyfish, if bits of the jelly, sticky bits of the jellyfish go off and they start sinking through the water, then stuff sticks to it, right? Other organisms or bits and pieces of sediments and things that are floating. And that's what they call marine snow. Well, it turns out in the oil spill, a lot of that oil got incorporated into this marine snow. And so it was like marine snow oil droplets that settled down to the bottom and created this whole sort of oiled zone on the seafloor. And that's been slowly degrading, but it's very interesting. You know, they're learning lots of really interesting stuff about exactly what happens. There are microbes. The Gulf of Mexico has always had oil seeps, natural oil seeps. In fact, a lot of the hints that there was oil in the Gulf of Mexico was because they had these gases that were seeping out of the seafloor, methane mostly. So there are natural organisms, natural bacteria, that can basically eat up that oil. And so one of the treatments that they try on at least smaller oil spills is they just grow a bunch of these bacteria, and then they let them loose on the oil and so that they can break down the oil, which is a lot less harmful than the Corexit and those things that they put on the oil to disperse it before. It turns out the Corexit dispersed the oil, and then it all kind of sank in these oil droplets, and then it's down there on the seafloor.
Oyster crops never recovered?
They got better. I think they're marketing them now, but they still have some areas that are in trouble. They didn't bounce back to, I don't think they're back to 100%. The fishing in that area is back, and the fish are safe, but they're also not back to 100%. But a lot of that is complicated by this whole Gulf of Mexico dead zone that's in sort of the same area as the oil spill, at least north of that area. So that's a zone where the oxygen goes down to basically not enough to support life about every late summer.
And now more dolphins are dying.
That's what I hear, yeah. And they're trying to figure out exactly why. The dolphins are, part of it may be directly due to the oil, but there are lots of other things going on. There's a lot more oil exploration. And when you have oil exploration, they do seismic studies first, and the air guns that they use create this huge boom, and dolphins and whales depend on sound for their navigation and to find each other, and the Navy also has sonar they've been testing that has really big booms. And so there's some thought that, you know, this increased seismic exploration may be having something to do with the dolphins and the whales beaching themselves that much more.
We also know about dead zones that are popping up globally. We used to talk about them just in the Chesapeake Bay, but we know they're happening all over.
Yeah, there's worldwide dead zones. They're quite often associated with where rivers dump out into the ocean. Or in the case of Chesapeake Bay, the Susquehanna River and other rivers, but particularly the Susquehanna, goes into the Chesapeake Bay. And what happens, a dead zone is just where at the bottom of the body of water, whatever it is, you have no oxygen. And the reason you have no oxygen is because it all gets used up as organic material degrades and gets eaten up. So the oxygen, remember, is produced at the surface where you have light. So in the case of the Chesapeake Bay, for instance, the increased sediments coming into the water makes the water murkier, which means the light can't get down as far, which means you don't get as much oxygen produced deeper. And then you have organic material that also sinks down there, and the oxygen gets used up. So the Chesapeake Bay goes almost completely anoxic by the end of the summer, just right in the center zone almost every year. The Gulf of Mexico, they first documented the dead zone there. It's to the west of the Mississippi River and the Atchafalaya River, which kind of comes off to the northwest of the Mississippi. It's a tributary, or it's what they call a distributary. It's a branch of the Mississippi River. And those carry a lot of nutrients, basically nitrogen from all the corn fields and all the agriculture that's up the Mississippi. Just like in the Chesapeake Bay, nutrients also come in. Then algae grows like crazy at the surface. That algae has two effects. It blocks the light, so you can't get light down as deep, right? So you're not going to get photosynthesis down as deep. And when that algae dies, it sinks. And if the bottom isn't too deep, so like in the Gulf of Mexico, this is happening on the continental shelf, so it's maybe 50 meters deep, half a football field or less. And therefore, when it sinks, then it rots and the oxygen gets used up. And so things like clams, oysters, things that live in the mud and can't go anywhere, basically die. And then fish, if they don't leave fast enough, die. And shrimp, and that's the big impact is on shrimp, because shrimp in the Gulf of Mexico, that's a big industry. And they live sort of associated with the bottom, munching things on the bottom. And they really need oxygen. They can't deal with low oxygen environments. And so the shrimp industry really took it on the chin. And that's been, they first documented in 1985, I think. Not because that's when it first appeared, but in 1985, they were going to do more oil exploration off of the Gulf of Mexico, and the, what was then the Marine Management Service, the Minerals Management Service, had to do surveys, bottom surveys. And so they went out and did a lot of cores in the Gulf of Mexico, and Nancy Rabelais, who's probably the expert on this whole Gulf of Mexico dead zone, discovered that in certain areas, these cores were just black and stinky and anoxic on this, you know, in the bottom, and or at the surface of the core, which meant there was no oxygen there. And then they started documenting it. I think 2017, the dead zone was the size of New Jersey. This year, they predict it'll be big again because of all this rain they've gotten in the Midwest, and there'll be that much more discharge.
So what should we do to prevent that? Hold on to your soil.
Hold on to your soil and reduce. They've been reducing the amount of fertilizer so that goes in. So, for instance, in the Chesapeake Bay, Lancaster County, they tried to persuade, for instance, a lot of the Amish don't spread as much manure, don't use as much artificial fertilizer, because fertilizer is mostly nitrate. This is the active thing, nitrates and phosphates. And the phosphates get sort of stuck in the soil pretty quickly, so they're not the problem. But the nitrates don't stay in the soil. They get flushed out. So if the corn or the soybeans or whatever you're growing doesn't use them, then they just go right out through the water and get into the river and then get carried down. That's why there's a seasonality to the dead zone, because there's a seasonality to when the fertilizer is applied.
So I should hold on to my soil when I see the Susquehanna River, a rich brown chocolatey milk torrent. That's our soil.
That's our soil going.
Help it create a dead zone.
Right, yeah.
So it should be worse in the past 2 years, in the Chesapeake Bay anyway.
Yep, probably.
Because of the rain.
Yeah. But even if you trap the soil, the nitrate is going to be dissolved. So it will continue to go. You know, if you manage to somehow keep the soil from getting in the water, the nitrate will go with the groundwater, and it'll get into the river, even if you trap the soil.
Yeah. So just take another
it's kind
route.
Of a double whammy.
Anything else you care to tell us? There's really so much going on. I started out with the state of the river, and these are state of the ocean. These are the details associated mm-hmm. with that.
There's just so much we need to learn about the ocean. And that's one thing that makes me kind of sad about the Gulf. The BP, you know, they did this, funded this great research effort, but this is year 10 of 10 years. And this year they're not funding any more new data collection. You know, they're basically trying to wrap up all the data, the results that they have. And short of funding from elsewhere, you know, it's going to be this big research effort that's going to kind of go get stuck. And funding for studying the oceans, at least the U.S. funding, has been held to, through National Science Foundation, held its own last year, is going to be cut, they think, this year. And really, this is a time we should be studying them more. And it's an expensive proposition, because you either need ships or you need, and lots of lab equipment, of course, and you need ROVs are expensive. And I think those efforts need to continue, because it's the more we know about it, then maybe we'll have some answers to some of these. It's easier to find the problems than it is to find the solutions.
All right, one more question.
Yeah.
Think Jurassic. I saw a movie
mm-hmm.
about a megalodon.
Ah, yes.
Is that possible that a prehistoric extinct shark could be that big and still be living somewhere?
That's a loaded question. But,
well, there might be some.
There
one
could.
Place,
it's a big ocean.
Where.
We haven't. Yeah, yeah we haven't.
You haven't been everywhere.
We haven't been everywhere.
So there might be a megalodon.
Might be a megalodon. But Robert Ballard has a ship. So one of his quotes was, because he gave a talk here at Bloom, actually, and he said, you know, the surface of the we know more about the surface of the moon than we know about the bottom of the ocean. It's so unexplored. You know, we know something about the shallow parts where it's, you know, where we've done bottom surveys. But if you can look even at a picture of, you know, map of the world's oceans, the South Pacific, pretty much totally unexplored. Okay. And then there are a lot of deep spots, and maybe there's a megalodon. You would think we would have seen it.
Yeah. I want there to be one.
You would think we would have seen one, but, you know, in the early 1900s, these fishermen off Japan pulled up this weirdo fish that was only known from the fossil record, the coelacanth, and basically it was still living just fine. They said, oh, yeah, we catch these every now and then.
There are
some scientists that actually just go to fish markets in places like Africa to see if they can see anything new.
Oh, to see what's been caught.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you. I had an enjoyable time.
Dr. Cynthia Van Bloomsburg University oceanographer and geologist and senior professor here at BloomU.